shall we get started? Good. So turn the recorder on?
Yes, sir. All right.
Did it. Thank you very much. Very good. All right. I apologize for not having been here at the last lecture, which I know the capable Dr. Moshewitz did for me. And I know what she talked about, but so my name is Feierstein, Stuart Feierstein, professor in biology. I also teach the neuroscience course regularly, so I'm going to finish this short neuroscience section here that we do in the general biology course, which Dr. Moshewitz started for you last time. So we're going to extend now the discussion from where it was last week. The key points, I hope, of last time's discussion being that neurons are able to develop a voltage across their plasma membrane, a membrane potential, as we often call it, either voltage or potential. Typically we call it the membrane potential. And they develop this voltage across their plasma membrane, being typically minus some number of millivolts inside with respect to outside. They do this in two ways. They have an unequal distribution of ions, which gets set up initially by some active pumping, which costs some energy. But once those unequal distributions of ions, in particular potassium and sodium, are set up, then the whole key to the rest of it is selective permeability. The ability for the membrane, the lipid membrane, which is normally not permeable to charged particles, to make itself selectively permeable to either potassium or sodium. And when selectively permeable to potassium at the given concentrations that are typically found in physiological setups, the physiological circumstance, you will have an equilibrium potential. A voltage will develop across that membrane at equilibrium of about minus 90 millivolts. On the other hand, if your selective permeability is to sodium, given the concentrations that exist in physiological situations, then you will develop a membrane potential of about plus 50 millivolts. Now note, it's sometimes confusing to students, and I can easily understand why, that in both cases you're using a positively charged ion. Nonetheless, in one case, that of potassium, you get a negative resting potential, a negative equilibrium potential of minus 90. And in the other case, for sodium, you get a positive equilibrium potential for plus 50. And that's because of the differential concentrations across the membrane. Which one is at a higher concentration in the cells versus outside the cell? And so you can get a negative membrane potential with the particular concentration set up so that you have both a chemical and a chemical diffusion, and electrical equilibrium that gives you a negative membrane potential. Okay? The key concept here, I think has been pointed out, is this selective permeability. And that will become important in our further discussions now. So that's why I want to make sure that you have that notion of a selective permeability. All right, so we have a neuron that establishes a voltage, which we call the resting membrane potential, typically somewhere around minus 70 millivolts. Now, I always use a bunch of different numbers here, and that seems to confuse people. A resting membrane potential can be quite variable. Different neurons in different parts of the brain or in different animals will have slightly different resting membrane potentials. They vary anywhere from, I'd say, minus 50, which is a rather positive resting membrane potential, and that's what you have in the photoreceptors in your eye. They maintain a kind of a high resting membrane potential, to minus 75 or 80 or so for certain kinds of neurons. It doesn't really matter so much what it exactly is. A cell comes to its particular resting membrane potential because it has some combination of selective permeability to potassium and sodium in a certain ratio. If the ratio favors potassium by a whole lot, the equilibrium potential, the resting membrane potential, will move towards the potassium equilibrium potential of minus 90. If, on the other hand, the resting membrane potential, the cell has a lot more sodium channel or a few more sodium channels open, and the ratio of potassium to sodium is not as great, it'll be more positive. It'll be more towards the sodium equilibrium potential. And that's how you come up with a particular resting membrane potential. An average, sort of typical resting membrane potential is about minus 70 millivolts. So we'll sort of work with that number. But you'll see different ones. So you may see examples in the book, the textbook, or in papers that you read. Somebody say, oh, the cell was resting at minus 65 millivolts. Okay, not a big deal. It's somewhere in that neighborhood. Okay, so we now have a cell, a neuron, that has established a resting membrane potential. That's all great, but what are you going to do with that? I mean, the whole thing about neurons is that you don't really want them loafing around at rest all the time. You want them working for you, right? So how do they work? What do they do in order to work away from this resting membrane potential? And in order to do that, we introduce another kind of a potential, which we call an action potential. And the action potential, then, is this rapid and transient change in membrane potential. Action potentials, as you'll see in a moment why, are designed really for sort of three things. One is they're rapid. Two is they're highly reliable. And three is that they're good for long-distance communication, long-distance transmission. They can travel over long distances. Remember that there's a neuron in your body that's a couple of meters long, and a blue whale it's like 40 meters long. So there's a very, you know, some of these cells have these very long axons, and so messages, information, electrical potentials have to travel sometimes long distances in the brain. They have to go there fast, they have to get there reliably, and they have to go over long distances. And it's the action potential that's in many ways the key to this. So let's see what an action potential is and then how it arises. So let's imagine that we start out here. Let's just make a plot. So this is voltage. We'll call this V sub M for membrane potential. All right, the membrane voltage. And over here is, in that direction is time. So let's put a couple marks in here. Let's say this is minus 90 millivolts. And that's what we call the equilibrium potential for potassium. Sometimes EK for equilibrium potential. It could be V sub K also, but traditionally it's EK. Equilibrium potential for potassium. Remember E, potential and voltage, all the same thing. Okay? So the membrane potential or the equilibrium potential for potassium is minus 90. Let's go up here. Let's put in plus 50. That is, sorry, the equilibrium potential for sodium. So let's say plus 50, right around here is zero. Let's say then here is about minus 70. This is all in millivolts, right? Don't confuse that. Millivolts is just the units, not the opposite of V sub M, which is membrane voltage, okay? So all these numbers are in millivolts. So here's minus 70. Let's call that the resting membrane potential. So here's the cell. We put an electrode in it, tootling along at about minus 70 millivolts, sitting there minding its own business. At time t, somewhere here, we stimulate it in some way. I don't know, kick it, pinch it, spit on it, whatever you want to do to it at this point. It doesn't really matter, but there's some stimulus that comes in that somehow or another activates this cell. And what we see is the membrane begins to go a little bit positive. Now, I have to introduce two new terms here, which are sort of slightly difficult terms. They're simple, but they're not what they sound like. So one is depolarization. So we say that if a membrane is not at zero millivolts, it's polarized, right? It's electrically polarized. It's more negative on the inside than the outside, and therefore there's some polarity to the cell membrane. So to depolarize the membrane, we mean typically that from whatever voltage it's at, it's moving to a less negative voltage. It's moving to a more positive voltage than where it is. Now, this is the way it's used, and that's what it really means. So if I say the cell membrane is depolarizing, that means it's getting more positive. Now, in point of fact, if it got to zero millivolts, that would be unpolarized. And if it then went to plus 10 or plus 20 millivolts, that would really be polarizing again, but in the positive direction. But that's not the way we use it. We still say, even if the cell is going from, I don't know, minus 10 to plus 10, that it's still depolarizing. So it's an inappropriate use of the word, but that's the way it's used. So depolarization simply means the membrane is going from whatever level it's at to a more positive voltage. On the other hand, hyperpolarization is just the opposite, which is that whatever level the membrane is at, it's now getting more negative. Okay, so depolarization in shorthand, or is a sort of shorthand for the membranes getting positive or more positive, and hyperpolarization, the membranes getting more negative. All right, so here's a stimulus, and for whatever reasons, and we'll talk about those in a moment, this begins to depolarize the membrane. It begins to make the membrane go more positive. Stimulate the cell, you kick it, spit on it, whatever it is, and it kicks the cell into a slightly more positive voltage. It may not go very positive, maybe just 5 or 10 millivolts, something like that. It gets, and then it just sort of sinks back again to its resting potential after a short time. You kick it once, it does that, that's the end of it. Okay? So it's depolarized slightly, but not very much. So let's give it a swifter kick, as it were, a stronger kick, a more intense punch, a brighter light, a louder sound, whatever it is this neuron is sensitive to. And now it depolarizes again. And if that depolarization reaches about minus 50 millivolts, it hits what we call a threshold point. And quite suddenly, the membrane shoots up to a very positive level, typically around plus 20 millivolts, let's say, somewhere between plus 10 and plus 20 millivolts. So it shoots up very rapidly, reaches a sort of a peak, and then not quite as rapidly, but almost so, begins to hyperpolarize, begins to come back down to negative voltages, and indeed will go down to almost minus 90 millivolts, will go below its resting potential for a period of time, and then slowly kind of relax back to its resting potential of minus 70. And this rapid transient change in voltage, a depolarization followed by hyperpolarization, is called the action potential. Now, because we're biologists, we have a name for like every little part of this action potential, because that's what biologists do, they name shit. So that's what we're going to do. We have a lot of that. I don't know why, it's a thing we do. So let's look at the parts of this, all right? So this is the initial depolarization, and this inflection point here is called the threshold. There's a picture of this in the handout. You can label it if you want, and I'm guessing there's a picture in the book that already has the labels on it. But this is a threshold point. If you reach that threshold, you'll get an action potential. If you don't reach it, the cell will just go back down to where it was again. So there's some threshold that's required in order to get you to this action potential. This, not unexpectedly maybe, is called the rising phase. So this rapid depolarization is the rising phase. Here's the peak. Not surprisingly, this is the falling phase. And this bit down here where it goes under the resting membrane potential, this has a couple of names because it's sort of important, believe it or not, even though it looks like just a little blip here. But this is called the undershoot, typically, or more technically, the refractory period. And why will become clear in a moment. And actually, this refractory period can be split into two sections. The first part of the refractory period is called the absolute refractory period. And the second part is the relative refractory period. This may all sound like just quibbles here, but it turns out these are important, and we'll get to it a little bit later. Okay? So the undershoot or the refractory period actually has two sections. The initial one, the absolute, and the later part of it, the relative refractory period. This entire thing, from the threshold through the refractory period, takes about 2 to 3 milliseconds. It's very fast. And a typical neuron can fire off a bunch of these. So as many as 150 to 200 per second. More typically firing rates, we call them firing rates of neurons, are something like 4 to 20 or 4 to 40 action potentials per second. But it's quite possible for them to fire off 150 or 200 of them per second. Now here's the key thing about this action potential. It is what we call invariant. So except that maybe it starts at minus 60 millivolts, maybe the threshold is closer to minus 45, the peak may be plus 10 or plus 20, but within these little kinds of differences that you'll find from one cell to another, every action potential in every animal and every neuron looks just like that. They all start somewhere near the resting potential. They all exceed 0 millivolts by 10 or 20 millivolts. They all take a couple of milliseconds, and they all fall back down that way. Particularly within any given neuron, all of the action potentials it ever fires will look exactly like this. Will look look exactly like each other. So they're largely invariant. They're invariant in size, what we call amplitude, and they're invariant in time. That is how long they last. Now here's the other key thing about action potentials. Everything your brain knows about the world is encoded by action potentials. This is the coin of the realm in the brain. This is how brain cells communicate. This is how they signal. So every stimulus out there in the world eventually becomes an action potential or a group of them. So this is a little puzzling, maybe. I mean, it's a complicated world out there. We seem to do complicated stuff. We see lots of colors. We see paintings. We can get around in trails. We can talk about action potentials. That's pretty complicated. How do we do that when all we have is this invariant sort of binary signal? You either get it or you don't. It's an all or nothing thing. You hit threshold, get an action potential. Bingo. And they all look the same. So there are two ways that this simple mechanism encodes the world for us. One has to do with the frequency with which they fire. So the more intense a stimulus, the faster or more rapidly you'll get action potential. So intensity is encoded by frequency. So a little soft sound, you might only get one or two action potentials along the auditory nerve. A louder sound, you'll get 10 or 20. An even louder sound, you'll get 40 or 50 or more per second along the auditory nerve. So it's a big stimulus, great intensity, higher frequency of firing. Low stimulus, lower intensity, lower frequency of firing. You can also, to some extent, there's also a kind of a population code. So you have a lot of neurons in your ear that hears things. And if it's a loud sound, you'll sort of recruit more of them. And so not only will they fire at a higher frequency, but you'll get more of them firing away. So there's a little bit of a population code. But nonetheless, it's all done essentially with the number and rate with which action potentials are fired. That's intensity. What about quality? That is it visual? Is it light? Is it sound? Is it touch? Is it smell? We call those things quality of the stimulus. And that's all pathway dependent. That is, your optic nerve, when light impinges on it, when electromagnetic radiation impinges on your retina, it eventually induces action potentials in the axons of your ganglion cells, which make up the optic nerve. So action potentials of an invariant size and time travel down the optic nerve and find connections in the brain. Those places in the brain where the optic nerve goes expect to be seeing visual information. They expect to be hearing about visual information, and so it's interpreted as such. On the other hand, your eighth cranial nerve, which comes from your ears, is encoding auditory information. And so action potentials on the eighth cranial nerve, the auditory nerve, go to parts of your brain that are anticipating and will analyze, quote, auditory information. If you could do the bizarre experiment, which we can't do, probably don't want to do, but couldn't do anyway, of taking your optic nerve and your auditory nerve and unplugging them and switching them around and plugging your optic nerve into the auditory portions of your brain and the auditory nerve into the visual portions of your brain, you would indeed see sound and hear light. That would be your experience. I know you don't believe that. So I have an experiment. Well, it's not an experiment I think you should do, but it's one you'll understand immediately because you've all probably had the experience. So in any of our sensory systems, we have specialized receptor cells. So in our eye, we have cells that are specialized to be stimulated by electromagnetic radiation, by photons, basically. But enough of any kind of energy will stimulate them. It's just that they're most sensitive to electromagnetic energy. Just like in your nose, you have cells that are most sensitive to chemical energy. But if you, for example, let's take the case somebody punches you in the eye. All right, what do you experience? The first thing is pain, of course, because you have all this tissue and bone all around your eye, and that hurts. That's mechanical energy. All right, but beyond that, you also experience what? A flash of light. Now, there's no light in a punch. There's no light there at all. But the mechanical energy is sufficient to make some of your photoreceptors fire off anyway. because a lot of energy was imparted to them. You could do this by sticking an electrode in your eye. I don't recommend doing this at home, mind you. But you stick an electrode in your eye and give an electrical stimulus, and that will stimulate them too. There's no light. But you will experience this as a flash of light in your brain. Because energy, because action potentials that come along the optic nerve will be interpreted by the brain as light, no matter what the actual source of those action potentials is. And so the quality of the stimulus is determined almost entirely by the pathway along which it travels. And remarkably enough, with just these two notions, intensity and quality, frequency and pathway, we can encode a very, very complicated world using largely these signals here, these action potentials. It's important to do it this way because an analog system, and this is kind of a digital system, you either get one or you don't get one, and the rate at which you get them is what's critical. And where they are is what's critical about action potentials. If you used a purely analog system, and some bits of the brain do use something a little more analog-like, but a purely analog system would be pretty unreliable, and it wouldn't go very far. I'll show you a little later on why these action potentials are so critical for long-distance information, for the message traveling a long distance. Otherwise, it would be a very inefficient system. So you might have a very rich world, but you'd be eaten very quickly in it. So, because you need something that goes fast and travels quickly. Okay? And so that's how, out of an invariant signal like this, you can encode this rather complicated world. All right, so it being so important that, let's see if we can understand how it is that this action potential arises, what gives rise to it. And we can understand it. We can understand it in some reasonable detail, in fact, because we have all the tools already to figure it out. So let's go back just for a moment and look at selective permeability. As you can imagine, I hope you can imagine, the way to understand this action potential, this rapid change in voltage, is going to have something to do, a lot to do actually, once again, with selective permeability. Otherwise, why would I have spent so much time bullshitting about it before this, right? So you can imagine this is an important idea. Okay, it's going to be even more important now. So remember that selective permeability arises in cells because of these specialized proteins called ion channels. And we have a couple different kinds, right? So we have, let's say, this one here, which we call a sodium channel, because this channel has the attribute of being an aqueous pore through the lipid membrane that happens to be able to select for sodium ions. Let sodium ions flow through easily, but it rejects potassium ions. Okay, so this is a sodium channel. Sodium ions, welcome to go through. It's a sodium channel. Here's the other thing this channel has on it. It has a gate, what we call a gate, right? Somehow or another, it has this little door. Now, maybe it's actually a door, or maybe it's just sort of, you can think of it like an iris in a camera. It closes and it opens. I mean, there are all sorts of mechanisms we think these channels use to open and close. Some of them we know a little more about, some of them less so yet. But in any case, what we do know is empirically by observing them in electrical recordings that they can either be open or closed. So we imagine they have some sort of a gate on them that closes them up. And when that gate's closed, no ions get through. When the gate's open, ions get through. So you can imagine then, when the gate is open, this is a kind of permeability. This means that membrane is now permeable to sodium. So we call that a permeability, or sometimes, because it's sort of electrical, we call it a conductance. We say that when the channel is open, it acts as a conductance, in this case for sodium, right? It conducts sodium ions through it. And therefore, sodium ions will travel from one side of the membrane to the other, and so you'll get a current. You'll get a sodium current. Conductance we use the electrical symbol G for, and current we use the electrical symbol I for. So we can say there's a sodium conductance, G sub Na. That refers sort of to the channel, the open channel. And that'll give you a current called I sub Na. What makes this door, this little gate, open and close? Well, a number of things can do it, but what we're interested in are gates that open and close as a result of voltage. And there are many that do this. Indeed, there's a particular kind of sodium channel in which the gate that controls conductance in the channel is sensitive to membrane voltage. So you might imagine, that's not so unusual to think about. Here you have this nice big voltage inside to outside of the cell. There's a nice big fat voltage field there. And so when it changes, you can imagine these channels are made up, they're proteins, they're made up of amino acids, many of them have charges on them. And so in an electrical field, a changing electrical field, they'll change their shape. Things will swing around on them, parts of the protein will move, and a gate will open and allow ions to flow through. And they do this at certain voltages. Sodium channels, it so happens, are closed when the membrane is hyperpolarized, when it's very negative, but they open when it gets more positive. And indeed, right around minus 50 millivolts is when they sort of most like to begin coming open. And the more positive the cell goes, the more likely it is that any given sodium channel will open its gate. Now, there are millions of these things sticking in the membrane. And so at any moment, the cell has a certain number of them that it's got open, and that is what gives you the permeability of the cell to sodium, or we sometimes say it's conductance. All right, so let's imagine how that happens. Where do I do this? I'll do this here. We'll come back to that. Okay, so let's say initially you do something to the cell which depolarizes it. This is still a little bit of a mystery, which we'll come back to later, how you get this initial depolarization. But bear with me. There's some stimulation, could be light, sound, or whatever it is, that the cell is sensitive to that gets it initially depolarized. And if it depolarizes, all right, so let's start with depolarization. Just means the membrane moves positive. Now, because the gates on that sodium channel are sensitive to voltage, and they tend to open as the cell depolarizes, this initial depolarization will cause an increase in the sodium conductance, we say. That is, most simply, more sodium channels will open. All right, so if sodium channels open, here we are at about minus 50 millivolts and some sodium channels open up. You're a sodium ion. What do you want to do? What's your best choice here? You're looking, let's say you're outside the cell. You're looking at a cell inside, very negative, minus 50 millivolts. You're carrying a big fat positive charge with you, right? So it's very negative inside. Not only that, there's almost no sodium guys in there. All the sodium are sitting out with you outside. So what do you want to do when you suddenly see a hole open up in the membrane? You want to go where the party is, right? So in you go to the cell. So sodium ions begin flowing in the cell at a high rate. It's very, very attractive in there. It's negative. I'm positive. It's negative. Cool. It's a low concentration. I'm sitting here in a high concentration. Even better. So sodium ions flow rapidly into the cell. So that means, for example, that you're getting a large sodium current. Right? Ions, charged particles flowing is a current. So now you have an increase in the sodium current into the cell. All right, so positive ions are going into the cell. What's that going to do to the membrane voltage? Make it more positive. It's going to lead to depolarization. Huh, so the cell gets a bit more positive. So now, what happens? Some more sodium channels decide, I'm getting into this game too. I'm going to open my gates now too. So their gates come open. So what happens? More sodium ions flow through the cell. You increase the sodium conductance, increase the sodium current, more sodium ions flow into the cell, more depolarization. Cool. More sodium channels open their gates. More sodium current, more depolarization. So you can see what happens. Here's this threshold, and this sudden, rapid rising, depolarizing phase is due to this intense, explosive, if you will, positive feedback cycle. We call this a positive feedback cycle because it continues to feed on itself. It just increases itself. So once you hit this threshold and you get enough of these sodium channels open to get some depolarization and get some more sodium channels open, then you're on your way. And it becomes literally explosive. I mean, in less than a millisecond, boom. You're up, I don't know, 80 millivolts or so, 90 millivolts from where you were. Okay? So that's the rising phase. That's good. But I mean, this can't go on forever. Your brain would explode, right? I mean, that's not good at all. You can't just let a positive feedback cycle run on forever. So there has to be something that slows this down somehow. And there are actually three things that slow it down. One of them is another kind of ion channel. And these are potassium channels. So these channels are happy to let potassium flow in or out, but not sodium. Now they also have a gate on them. And these potassium channels, their gate is also voltage sensitive. But it's got a slightly different voltage sensitivity than the sodium channels do. Not hard to understand why they would be slightly different. It's a different protein. They have a different set of amino acids with different charges on them lined up. They still make a hole in the membrane, but the gates are constructed differently. Sodium channels are very sensitive to voltage in this range here, and in depolarization, the gates fly open. Potassium channels also open their gates in response to depolarization, but not until you hit about minus 10 millivolts or so. So they come on much later. So initially, in this little scheme up there, you're opening sodium channels, but there's no potassium channel. There's very little potassium channel open, which is why you go towards the sodium equilibrium potential. You get very positive. But now, as you get up around minus 10 or so, you begin to open a few potassium channels. Now, how do you feel about being a potassium ion when you see a potassium channel open? When you see one of these gates open, you're sitting inside the cell. It's getting to be kind of positive in there. It's minus 10. Your equilibrium potential, which is where you don't have to do anything, is at minus 90. Now it's all the way up at minus 10 and getting more positive. So you've got a positive charge on you. You don't want to be in there. Plus, there's a ton of other potassium ions in there, and there's almost nobody on the other side of that membrane. And so for potassium ions, when this channel opens at around minus 10 millivolts, the only way to go is out. And so potassium ions go out through their selective permeability, through their ion channel. What happens when potassium ions go out? This is a positive charge leaving the cell. Now the cell becomes more negative. So now you're going to begin depressing this depolarization, and indeed, you're actually going to begin this hyperpolarization. Now, there's two other things that stop this depolarization. One of them is that as the cell becomes more and more depolarized, as it gets more and more positive, the sodium ions that are out there, even with an open channel, are less interested in getting into the cell. After all, it's gotten kind of positive in there. So even though their chemical diffusion gradient would still put them in the cell, it's a little positive electrically in there, and so it's not as easy for them to get in. Down here at minus 50, it was a free-for-all, right? Big chemical diffusional gradient, very attractive electrical gradient, rush in. But as the cell becomes more positive, that electrical gradient, that electrical field, is less amenable. It's less good-looking to a sodium ion. And so they slow down. The current slows down, even though the channels are open. The second thing is that sodium channels have this funny gate on them, which not only it activates around here, but as things get more positive, it swings shut. It inactivates or closes, we say. And so sodium channels are actually beginning to close. So three things are happening somewhere around minus 10 millivolts or so. Potassium channels begin opening. Sodium channels begin closing, and the desirability for a sodium ion to go into the cell is lessening. All of those things conspire to let the cell get up to about a peak, but then come back down again. And they do that by adding a negative feedback cycle to this. So at some point, although depolarization is doing this, it's also a little later in the game leading to an increase in the number of open potassium channels, or an increase in the potassium conductance, or an increase in potassium permeability. All three of the things I just said are the same thing. Okay, increase in potassium conductance, or permeability, or number of channels open. That leads to an increase in the potassium current. But remember, potassium current is going out. When I say an increase in sodium current, it's coming into the cell. But when the potassium current increases, it's going out, because that's the favorable direction for it to go, both down its chemical and electrical gradient. What happens when potassium leaves? You get a hyperpolarization. And so this ends it. And this is responsible here. So in this downward trail here, you have fewer and fewer sodium channels open, less and less, we call it a driving force on sodium channels, less and less interest in sodium ions to come into the cell, more potassium ion channels open, more potassium current, and that's responsible for this rapid hyperpolarization. Indeed, it's so strong that at some point it takes it almost all the way down to the potassium equilibrium potential, at which point you have virtually zero sodium channels open, and the only permeability is to potassium. It becomes like that original sort of model cell we said, where, gee, what if you had a cell which only had potassium permeability? Well, its membrane voltage would be the same as the equilibrium voltage for potassium. And that's what you have here. And so that's why you get this huge undershoot. After that, some of the sodium channels begin to come back on again. The sodium channels are a little more confusing than I've made out. They actually have two gates on them. So, and the two gates are open at slightly different voltages, and they have to work in concert. The sodium channels have to actually be reset in order to work again. And this is an important point. Once that sodium channel closes, as it gets more depolarized, it cannot reopen again until it becomes very negative. But once the membrane is negative, the channel is reset and it can open again. It's a little bit like a mousetrap, right? You set the mousetrap, you spring it. It does what it does. It's done doing what it does. And it can't work again until you reset it again. That's the way sodium channels are. They spring open as the cell depolarizes and becomes more positive. They stay open for a little time, but then they have another gate that closes on them. And then that whole thing can't be reactivated again until it goes more negative. And that becomes important. Well, I'll tell you why it becomes important right now, in fact. Because at this point here, this absolute refractory period, you're still reactivating your sodium channels. So during this absolute refractory period, it is virtually impossible to have another action potential. I don't care how strong the stimulus, you can't get the cell to fire another action potential right in this area here. There are virtually no sodium channels available. Everything is potassium. And so it's just really hard to stimulate it enough to get enough depolarization to get the cell back up to a threshold where sodium will work. It just doesn't happen. But as the sodium channels come back online, then you're in this relative refractory period. And then with a stronger stimulation than it initially took, you can get another action potential. But it takes a stronger stimulation. Or you can just wait till the cell gets back out to its resting state, and then a normal size stimulus will get it to fire again. As I'll show you in a moment, this has important consequences. Number one, on the rate with which a cell can fire, so how fast it can fire action potentials, and also on what direction they can go and how they move from one part of a cell to the next. Okay? Does this make sense so far? Are there questions? Yeah.
Is the refractory period just because of the potassium ion channels, or is it also something that
Well, this is a good point. Yes. So the question is this refractory period due to the fact that it's just now it's all potassium channels open, there aren't many sodium channels available, or is it that we've changed the concentration so much here because of all these ions flowing back and forth that you can't get another one together? It has zero to do with concentration. So this is an important point, which I was about to get to. Thank you for the question. I keep on talking here like, you know, oceans of potassium and sodium are sloshing back and forth in and out of the cell. That's not actually the case. Relatively few ions actually flow in order to make this process work. Remember that the concentration of ions we're talking about are quite high. So 140 millimolar, you work this out for yourself if you'd like, take 140 millimolar potassium and take a typical neuron has a volume of about 200 femtoliters. You can work out with Avogadro's number how many potassium ions that is. I can tell you it's a few gazillions or so, I mean, just as a rough estimate. It's a large number. You would never be able to change the concentration in any significant way, especially over this time period. So what's the actual mechanism here? It's not really concentration. What the cell is doing is it's switching back and forth between its selective permeabilities. It's adjusting how permeable it is to one ion or the other. If the cell is only permeable to potassium, its membrane will race towards the potassium equilibrium potential. Because that's where an equilibrium potential is. It'll nail it right there. If, on the other hand, the cell switches off all the potassium permeability and turns up sodium permeability, it'll race towards plus 50 millivolts. just by being more permeable to that ion, you don't actually have to have that much current flowing. Now, there is current flow, because that's what happens in a conductance. But it takes very, very few ions. So, for example, even though it only takes a few ions, at some point this would all run down, right? And in fact, cells maintain pumps. They have other proteins in the membrane that pump ions back and forth to get these concentration gradients, keep them stable. So, for example, there's a sodium-potassium pump. Pumps sodium out of the cell, potassium into the cell, and uses up an ATP or so to do that. Okay, so it's an energetic pump. But you can poison that pump. There are drugs that you can put on a cell that poisons the pump. It won't make the pump. The pump won't work anymore. Then you can stick an electrode into this neuron and stimulate it, let's say twice per second, so that 2 times per second you get an action potential. No pump. So how many action potentials like this could you get before the concentration gradients, in fact, run down and wouldn't support it anymore? Somewhere between 150 and 200,000 action potentials with no pump at all. So it would take 150,000 of these events before enough sodium and potassium ions flow back and forth to make the concentrations other than what they would work at, not the 140 versus 4 and the 130 versus 5 thing that we talked about last week, right? So there's really not much concentration. It would take forever to try and change the concentrations enough to change the voltage like this. You don't have enough time. You'd be eaten long before that ever happened. So it's not concentration changes. It's changes in selective permeability. It's as if you have your sodium permeability or your potassium permeability here, your sodium permeability here, and you've got a couple of levers, and you can just move them back and forth. And depending on where you set them, that's where your membrane potential is going to get set. Okay? So that's the principle, and that's what sort of evolution picked up here in neurons as a way to do this rapidly and reliably and without having to push a lot of ions back and forth across the membrane at relatively little energy. Takes almost nothing. But once you make these proteins and stick them in the membrane, it costs nothing to operate them. They're just sensitive to the voltage. A voltage that you don't even bother to really spend any energy making. So it's a very efficient process. A very efficient process. Okay? And the key, again, is selective permeability. Yeah. Sorry, is there a... No, you know, I just draw it there. There's never a clear-cut point. This is biology. I have to give those ideas up, I'm afraid. Not exactly. It's always a balance. So, you know, they sort of slide one into the other. My favorite analogy with this, because there's so many, for some reason, other plumbing analogies in neuroscience. I don't really know why. But if you think about it, this is a good mnemonic, that really the best way to think about an action potential and understand its mechanism is to think of a toilet, I'm sorry to say. So, you know, you have a toilet, and you know the way you can play with the handle there? You can sort of do it a little bit and pull back, and it won't quite flush. That's like this thing here, right? It doesn't quite go. But you know, you play with it, and all of a sudden you just go one little teeny bit too far, right? And that's it. Kaboom! Flush, right? No matter what. You've hit the threshold, you've got a flush. And it does that big flush thing, you know, everything goes down. And then that all turns off, right? Those valves close up, and they can't open again. They can't be reset until it begins to fill up. Now that's the falling phase, this hyperpolarization, this resetting of the whole thing. And then, you know, there's even like this absolute refractory thing. No matter how much you yank on the handle, you're not going to get another flush out of it, you know? It ain't going to happen. But then there's this relative, you know, like you're in a rush, so you don't want to wait for the whole bowl to fill up again. So if you wait just long enough, you can kind of get another flush out of it, right? That's the relative refractory period. So it works quite well this way, right? So you know you'll remember the stages of the action potential every time you go to the toilet. But it does kind of work that way. And again, just like a flush, it's kind of invariant. You know, it just every time it's the whole flush. You don't flush at half the toilet or, you know, whatever. You don't judge that. Whatever you did in there, you just flush it all the way, right? That's it. And so action potentials are much the same. It's the same way, I'm sorry to say. Okay, we have any other questions about this? I know it's a sort of a tricky concept. It's not especially intuitive right off the bat, but the key thing to remember, I know I've said this now ad nauseum, but is this idea of selective permeability. You got a lot of bang for the buck out of a relatively simple idea, simple physical chemical process. All right, well, let us move on. See if I can't confuse you with the next thing if I haven't been able to do it with this one. Okay? And that would be now, so now we have an action potential, and this is nice, this is a good step along the way, but of course this is information, and the trick is to send this information somewhere to what we call, I just have to start erasing things here, what we call a process of propagation. So this means moving this down the pike some. So you remember that we had this sort of model cell sort of thing. And from one pole of the cell, here's the nucleus here. Here's the dendrites up here. This extensive dendritic tree and so forth. But from one pole was this special membrane. Let me draw this just a little bit larger. Called the axon. And it turns out that this particular membrane extension is somewhat specialized. It's loaded up with sodium channels, for one, so it's kind of ready to go, you know, ready to fire action. These voltage-gated sodium channels, what we call a voltage-gated channel, because the gate is controlled by voltage. And in particular, right around here, right where the axon kind of emanates from the soma of the cell, in this region right here, is something called the initial segment. And this is also a sort of specialized region of the cell loaded with sodium channels in particular. And so the threshold for firing an action potential is perhaps lower there than anywhere on the cell. I'm looking for a handout. Do I have a copy of the handout here? I have one earlier. All right, it doesn't matter. I think I remember what's on it anyway. All right, so there's this initial segment. And so you can imagine what happens is the cell gets inputs all over its dendrites from other cells talking to it or whatever stimulus it might be. We're still going to get to that. So it gets inputs all over the place in the dendrite, even all on the soma and so forth. And eventually it adds all these up. It integrates all this input. And if the input is enough such that it gets to be about, it raises its membrane potential to about minus 50 millivolts, then here in this initial segment, which experiences that minus 50 millivolts of membrane potential, you'll fire an action potential there. You'll start with an action potential right there in this initial segment. Now you want it to travel down the axon because you want to send this message from whatever, the middle of your spinal cord out to your big toe and tell it to get out of the way or say ouch, whichever it is, if it got stepped on or something like that, right? So you need to send this action potential down there. And the way it does this is most analogous to a fuse. So, you know, the way a fuse works is a fuse actually has little segments in it. And you put a match to one end of it and that heats it up a bit. And if you heat it up enough, it sort of explosively flares up and produces a lot more heat too, which will heat up the next segment of the fuse and get that heated up enough for it to go off and so forth. And it works its way down the fuse. And that's more or less what happens here too. So the idea is that sort of draw this real big. So here's an axon. There's the plasma membrane on either side of the axon. And it's got, every so often, regions in it which have lots of sodium and potassium channels. Regions that are separated by typically about 2 centimeters or so, something like that. Okay? And so the action potential, let's say, starts here. Sorry. And then, all right, so it starts there, it comes into the axon or whatever, and it begins to depolarize the next segment of axon. And that gets these sodium channels to open, and so sodium ions flow in and begin to start off another action potential here. And that spreading depolarization, the spread of the few sodium ions that come in, this depolarization, if you will, spread slightly down the axon just far enough to get the next set of sodium channels activated. And if they reach threshold, then boom, they fire. And again, you have an action potential there, which... So they actually, when you record from a nerve, they appear to jump, actually, from region to region on the neuron, on the axon. We call this saltatory conduction. for, it's a real Latin word for jumping or something like that. And so this conduction goes very rapidly. They go about, do they go about 10 meters a second, I think? When action potentials travel at about 10 meters per second, these action potentials can jump down the axon. What's important here is, if all you had was a depolarization like this, and that's what you fed in here, it would also travel down the axon. But it would die out after a little while, like any signal, like a signal in a wire. You put a voltage in a wire, and you send it away long enough, the other end, you don't get much out of it. Unless you have some boosters in the middle, some amplification somewhere in the middle to boost the signal. It's the same thing here. Just a simple depolarization, simple change in voltage, would just simply leak out of the axon after a while. It wouldn't get very far, and it would keep getting smaller and smaller the further away you got. Instead, what happens is, every couple of centimeters, you get another action potential. That's exactly the same as the one you fed into it. So the 10 meters away, by the time you get down there, you're getting the same action potential that you had here.
What if the signal goes down and up?
Good question. You know the answer to that question. So why does the signal only go this way, let's say? You put it in and it seems to only go this way, or at least from this point on it's only going to go this way. Why can't it go backwards? Right. You have a refractory period. So the membrane here, the membrane that had just passed, these sodium channels are kaput. They're out of business for a while. So you can't go back that way. This depolarized here. The sodium channels aren't working. You have an absolute refractory period going on there. But this one is not. These sodium channels are ready to go, and so it hops that way. And so that also is important because the message then remains unidirectional, if you will. It can't just back up on itself. Okay, so I told you in the beginning the importance of action potentials is they're rapid, they're reliable, and they're good for long distance measures. They travel long distances with great fidelity. And so that's what we have here. So at least if you get a message in, it's going to go somewhere and you're going to get the message wherever it has to go. Now there are numerous diseases and pathologies that have to do with this flow. There are on your handout, I think you'll see there are these sort of dark half circles here in between these regions where the sodium channels are. And they're supposed to depict the substance called myelin. Myelin is this fatty substance that are made by glial cells, and they actually wrap themselves around the axon. So imagine the axon's a tube, and this you're supposed to think of as being wrapped around the axon. And they're like insulation. It's like putting rubber on a wire. And that insulation stops things from leaking out in between. And wherever that insulation breaks, you have these nodes where you have all these sodium channels. So the action potential, another reason why the action potential appears to jump from place to place. So that's another sort of nicety, is this insulation business. Yeah?
And does it go to the big axon after the isodynamic
importance? Well, I don't know that they have to be. They are. Axons are always sort of, they're not cables that get thinner and thinner. They always stay the same diameter.
But the end, every end is equally.
Yes. Well, so sometimes axons will branch. Is that what you mean? That you can get an axon that comes out of the cell somehow like this, and at some point it'll branch. At some other point it might branch here and go there, so forth and so on. So yeah, typically an action potential, when it hits a branch point, will still, you'll get, so if you put an action potential in here, then you'll get it here, you'll get it here, you'll get it here, wherever you are, you'll get that same action potential out of it. Question? Okay. All right, so now we have a traveling wave of voltage here. We have this action potential. Now the next key thing is, where is it going? What are we going to do with it when it gets somewhere? And so far this is... Oh, the myelin. I was going to tell you about some pathology in myelin. Sorry, there are a couple of pathologies that are diseases of myelin. Multiple sclerosis is probably the most serious of them. But there's several diseases of conduction, what we call conduction in axons. Multiple sclerosis is one in which your immune system essentially attacks myelin and rips the myelin off of the nerves, and therefore they don't conduct at the correct speed anymore. And so you get all sorts of locomotor kinds of problems and sensory problems as well, because messages are not traveling now over the long distances, nor are they reliable as they were. There are a number of pathologies that have to do with conduction velocity in axons. It's a very important thing to regulate. So in the brain, yes, there's a lot of myelin in the brain as well. You've probably heard people talk about white matter and gray matter in the brain. So when you look at a brain, if you don't stain it with anything, you just look at a slice of brain, some of it looks kind of gray and some of it looks kind of white. The white matter is actually myelin. It's a very fatty, translucent substance. And so it reflects light as very white. The gray matter are cell bodies. The gray matter is cell, regular plasma membrane and cell bodies. And the white part of the brain matter, the white matter, is mostly myelin. So yeah, you get a lot of it up in the brain as well. Again, it's a question of leakage and insulation. You can pack things tighter if you have everything nicely insulated. So it's important there too. Okay? All right. So the next issue is how one brain cell talks to another brain cell. Because everything I've told you so far happens inside of one neuron. Well, that's great, but since you have 10 to the 11th neurons, they ought to be able to talk to each other somehow or another, and nothing much is going to happen. And they do that through a structure called a synapse. If you have 10 to the 11th neurons in your brain, you have about 10 to the 14th synapses. So an average of 1,000 synapses per neuron. So I'll make a small picture over here and a bigger one in the middle. So here again is this neuron. We'll drag the axon down here like this. It's off. And it's got this all these dendrites branching off it and so forth. And onto these dendrites in particular, other cells, their axons, meet up with these dendrites and make connections with them called synapses in this case. So imagine this axon here ends in this sort of synaptic swelling, if you will, and it's right next to some other cell's dendrite. And a given neuron, nucleus there, given neuron can have up to 1,000 or more, in some cases, in extreme cases, about 150,000 of these, of axons from other cells making connections with its dendrites. And then it sends its own axon out to connect with some other cells. And so this is the structure we're going to look at now. So the idea is that this message can be sent a long distance down to this sort of outpost down here, which we call the synapse. Sort of, this is like the home office here, and this is some semi-independent outpost down here. So let's have a look at this structure, okay? So here's the end of the axon. The synaptic thing, I believe this is in your handout. And here's the cell here. So, first thing we have is what we call the presynaptic element. And that's the axon and the synaptic terminal. And over on the other side here, we have the postsynaptic element. The synapse being this bit of nothingness, I guess, in between, sort of, okay? So in between the presynaptic element and the postsynaptic element is something called the synaptic cleft, which is indeed an open space. It's a little bit of space between them, typically about 20 to 30 microns. So there's an actual space here between the two membranes. All right, what are the elements of the presynaptic terminal? So the presynaptic terminal is just chock full of goodies that get sent down the axon and stored here by the cell. So lots of proteins, lots of other structures. In particular, it has a whole bunch of vesicles, little lipid vesicles. And in those lipid vesicles are lots of molecules of what we call neurotransmitters. Let me go back a half a step and tell you about neurotransmitters, I guess. All right. So one question that people had early on with synapses is, what's the nature of this connection? Do our neurons connect electrically, which is what you might think since they sort of work with voltages and currents and things like that, or is it a chemical connection? The electrical connection sounds more obvious somehow, but as is typical, it's not the case. There are electrical connections between cells, but they're relatively rare. Fewer than 5% of the synaptic connections between cells are electrical in nature. Most of them are chemical. This was first determined, I'm going to tell you about this experiment, by a man named Otto Loewi in, I believe, 1921, who did the following now famous experiment, I suppose. So Loewi took a beaker, which he filled with physiological solution, with sodium and potassium ions and things like that in it, and in that beaker, he placed a living frog heart. Okay? Now, you know, a heart will beat all on its own. It doesn't need anything. It just beats away. And so he looked at this beating heart, and it was beating away. Now, this heart he dissected out carefully so that it still had attached to it a branch of the vagus nerve, which innervates the heart. And if you stimulate the vagus nerve, just give it a little electrical shock, it will slow down the heart because there are synapses between the nerve. These are axons. When I say a nerve, I mean axons of cells. So these are a bunch of axons. They spread out over the heart. They innervate the heart, and they make synapses with the heart muscle. So synapses can be between neurons, or they can be between neurons and muscles. In this case, the synapse is between the neuron and the muscle, between these axons and the underlying muscle. And what happens is when you stimulate these cells, and thereby stimulate the synapses, the heartbeat slows down. So let's say that's the stimulus there, and so he observed that the heartbeat slowed down. This was not unexpected. This had been known for some time. The question was, what was the mechanism? Well, what Loewi did was he took another beaker, which he connected to this one, a separate beaker, but he connected them together. So they shared the same solution. And he put another frog heart in that beaker. But this frog heart had no nerve connected to it any longer. He had denervated it. So there's no nerve involved. Once again now, in experiment two, we'll do it up here, he watched this heart beating away, and indeed this heart beating away, and then he stimulated them. He stimulated this nerve. And this heart, as previously, slowed down. This heart continued to beat on at its regular speed for a while, and then it also slowed down. Loewi's conclusion was that the synapse here is chemical, that these axons here are releasing some chemical, that when the nerve is stimulated, they release some chemical which acts upon the heart to slow down the beating, and that that chemical could diffuse in this solution to this other heart and therefore act at a distance. And indeed, that's the case. The chemical happens to be acetylcholine, we now know, which was the first neurotransmitter discovered. And so at this point, it was understood that synapses were likely to be chemical, and it turns out that virtually all of them we find are chemical. And the way they work, then, is to have those chemicals, like acetylcholine, in these vesicles, packaged up in these vesicles. Now, the other major component of a presynaptic terminal are ion channels, but these ion channels are calcium ion channels. So these ion channels are selectively permeable to calcium. Not sodium, not potassium, but another ion that's found around. Calcium's an interesting ion because, first of all, it's got a double positive charge, so it's a potent ion. Secondly, it exists in the extracellular solution at about 2 to 4 millimolar, but inside cells, it's at a very, very low concentration, about 10 to the minus 7th molar. So out here, about 10 to the minus 3, and in here, 10 to the minus 7. 4 orders of magnitude different. So there's a very, very strong concentration gradient for calcium to move down. Much stronger, for example, than potassium or sodium, which between inside and outside have fewer than 2 orders of magnitude of concentration difference, right? There's 4 orders of concentration difference. So if calcium channels open, calcium will flow in at a pretty high rate. Calcium channels are also voltage gated. They have a gate on them that opens in response to depolarization. When the membrane gets positive, these channels will open. So that's exactly, in fact, what happens. An action potential comes traveling down the axon. It invades the presynaptic terminal. It makes it quite positive, plus 10 millivolts. Calcium channels open up, and calcium ions flux into the cell. Now, calcium ions are important activators of many enzymes. And there are about 25 or so proteins involved in the rest of this process that I'm going to tell you about. We're not going to talk about any of those. I just want you to know it's a whole complicated set of machinery in there that begins with calcium that activates the first of a series of these enzymes or proteins. What they do is they cause these vesicles to, we say dock, but essentially to merge with the plasma membrane of the postsynaptic terminal. So these vesicles move over to here, and they fuse with this membrane like that, and then their transmitter substance flows out. Okay, here's another one down here, let's say. Dozens, in some cases, of these vesicles for given action potential can fuse to the membrane and empty the contents, their transmitter contents, into this synaptic cleft. These molecules then diffuse across this synaptic cleft, and on the postsynaptic membrane are other proteins, which we call receptors, that are able to recognize these chemicals and bind them, and they activate these receptors. These chemicals are called neurotransmitters. And they activate a variety of different kinds of receptors that are found in the postsynaptic membrane, which we'll talk about in a moment. Alright, let's talk first about some of these neurotransmitters. They're all relatively small molecules, organic molecules. Most of them are either amino acids or they're derivatives of amino acids. So, for example, glutamate, a simple amino acid, is the major, what we call, excitatory transmitter in the central nervous system. So these chemicals, depending on the receptor here, can have two different effects on the postsynaptic cell. They can either be excitatory, we say, which means that they will depolarize the postsynaptic cell, or they can be inhibitory, which means they'll hyperpolarize the postsynaptic cell. In one case, here are the last two potentials I'm going to tell you about. If they're excitatory, then it's what we call an excitatory postsynaptic potential, or an EPSP. And you'll see this a lot in papers and books. EPSP means excitatory postsynaptic potential. And that means that when these transmitter substances are released and they bind to these proteins here, the cell will be depolarized. Right? So here now is how this depolarization can happen. So you get some depolarization when these transmitter substances bind to the postsynaptic membrane. Glutamate is maybe the most important excitatory transmitter, particularly in the central nervous system. Now you can also have inhibitory, and that's called an IPSP, inhibitory postsynaptic transmitter, because they'll bind to a receptor that will, instead of letting positive ions in, will let chloride ions into the cell, negative ions, and will actually depress the membrane. They'll hyperpolarize the membrane. And that's called an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. Another amino acid, not as common a one, called GABA, which stands for gamma-aminobutyric acid. That's not so important, but it's called GABA, is the main inhibitory transmitter in the central nervous system. About 30% of the synapses in your brain are inhibitory. They're very important. It's critical to have inhibitory systems in the brain. One of the main effects of having not such good inhibitory systems in the brain are things like epilepsy. Many other pathologies come from problems with the inhibitory pathways in the brain. Anxiety, things like that. Okay, so glutamate is excitatory, GABA is typically inhibitory. Both of these molecules activate receptors which we call, put them over here, ionotropic receptors, because the receptor is itself an ion channel, just like a sodium or a potassium channel, except its gate is activated, is opened by the binding of a chemical. So the gates are not sensitive to voltage, but instead, if a chemical binds to the protein, it changes its conformation and the gate comes open. If it's excitatory, like a glutamate-operated channel, then it lets in positive ions. If it's inhibitory, like a GABA-operated channel, it lets chloride ions in. And so it changes the membrane either more positive or less. The other major class of these transmitter substances are amino acid derivatives, and they include chemicals that you've probably all heard of, such as dopamine, epinephrine, and serotonin. Serotonin. These are all derived from amino acids. They use what are called metabotropic, sorry for these words, receptors, in that the receptor itself does not have an ion channel as part of it. It's a receptor, and then it activates a G protein or some other cascade of enzymes that produces second messenger like cyclic AMP that activates channels. It's a multi-step pathway. So some of them have an ion channel directly as part of the deal. You bind the chemical, the gate comes open. Some of them are receptors that then are part of an enzymatic pathway that sends the signal along to eventually to open channels, but not immediately. Okay, so far? All right, last bit of thing is the last kind of neurotransmitter, something of a surprise, one that's recently, or it's not quite as recently anymore, but was the subject of a Nobel Prize, and those are gaseous, believe it or not, neurotransmitters. Not chemicals at all, but gases. The most interesting of these being nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide, for some time, has been known to have effects on the heart. It's used as a medicine, and it turns out that it's actually a neurotransmitter. Neurons produce it. It's a gas. It just goes right through their membranes and acts on nearby cells. Nitric oxide acts on an enzyme called, this doesn't matter so much, but guanylyl cyclase, which produces a chemical called cyclic GMP. Cyclic GMP acts on many blood vessels to tend to relax them or open them. In fact, for a long time, nitric oxide, before we knew what it was called endothelial relaxing factor. We now know it was nitric oxide. Cyclic GMP is broken down by an enzyme called phosphodiesterase into an inactive form of GMP. And that turns everything off. So some years ago, there was a chemical, a drug developed for heart patients called, Sildenafil. Sildenafil, which was a phosphodiesterase blocker. So the idea was this drug, Sildenafil, would block the phosphodiesterase, so that when nitric oxide was around, it would make cyclic GMP, and the cyclic GMP would stay there. It wouldn't be broken up and taken away, and so the blood vessels would stay open. It's a very promising drug at first. It went all the way through the clinical trials, but about 3 or 4 weeks into the clinical trials, it was recognized it was having no effect whatsoever on these heart patients. And so they stopped the trials because it was dangerous to have heart patients on a drug that wasn't doing them any good, and they went around to collect the drug, and nobody would give this drug up. Well, it turns out this drug is now known more popularly as Viagra. So they couldn't get anybody to give this drug up, even though these guys had like serious heart problems. It makes you wonder about priorities, but okay. And then they asked why, and it turns out, of course, that the reason for this is that it was indeed a very good phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It just wasn't the right phosphodiesterase. There are about 10 isoforms of phosphodiesterase, and the one that it inhibits, thereby relaxing blood vessels and letting them fill, was not the one in the heart. It was the other one. But it still turns out to be effective. Now, an interesting side story here for cocktail parties is that this same phosphodiesterase happens to be found in your visual system. In particular, you have three sets of cones in your eye, red, blue, and green. And in the blue cones, they use this same phosphodiesterase to mediate visual transduction, we call it. And indeed, that's the reason that one of the side effects of Viagra is this sort of blue haze that you see. That's not just because it's a sex drug that it's a blue haze. It's actually because there's a biological reason. It's because it operates on the same phosphodiesterase as you find in your blue cones. And so this idea of nitric oxide is actually, I'm going to tell the story because I think it's fun, but it actually turns out to have many instances in which it's used all over the brain, in fact. And in particular, may be very important during development. It's a very active area of research. Okay, is it time for a question? I guess we're sort of done. What? I've turned something off. Okay. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.